Welcome to the Prader-Willi Syndrome edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the PWS community.
Hello, this is Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. Today we're talking with Dr. Jennifer Miller, a professor of pediatric endocrinology at the University of Florida, which just happens to be my alma mater. Dr. Miller, who's done all her training at UF in Gainesville, specializes in treating children with Prader-Willi syndrome and other causes of childhood excessive weight gain. In late June, Dr. Miller spoke at the 2023 Prader-Willi Syndrome Association's Medical and Scientific Conference in Orlando about current research and treatments. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, Prader-Willi syndrome, what is this disease about? How significant and how prevalent is the disease? And how did you begin researching this particular illness?
So Prader-Willi syndrome is a rare disease. It occurs in about 1 in 15,000 to 1 in 20,000 individuals born each year. It is a genetic condition that can just happen when there is a deletion of some way of part of dad's chromosome 15. So that can either be by a break in chromosome 15 that deletes part of that chromosome in the sperm, in spermatogenesis. It can happen by mom contributing two 15s and none from dad. So there are different ways, and there's other ways as well, but those are the most two common ways that it can occur. I got into it because I was interested in childhood obesity. And at the time, 20 some years ago, when I began my career, everyone with Prader-Willi syndrome had obesity early in life that continued and worsened throughout life. Now, since growth hormone therapy has been approved, since we know more about diet and physiology in the syndrome, we are able to keep a lot of these individuals normal weight during childhood. It becomes much more difficult, of course, once they're out of their parents' control, once they're in school or in high school particularly. And it's a very interesting syndrome, I think, because it starts off as babies with no desire to eat at all. Like, you basically have to force feed these children or they would die. So they don't want to suck. They don't cry for food. They will sleep through feeds. They will actually press their lips shut or tongue the bottle out of their mouth when they're infants if someone tries to feed them. So they have to be sort of force-fed through tubes, either through a gastrostomy tube or a nasogastrostomy tube, or in some countries, they'll just cut the nipple off the bottle and pour the milk down the throat of the child to keep them alive. Which is fascinating when you consider that the natural history of Prader-Willi and the thing most people know about Prader-Willi syndrome is that when they're older, they develop this insatiable appetite. They'll eat anything and everything. They don't necessarily feel full. They'll talk about one meal while finishing another. It's almost as if eating makes it worse. Eating makes them...
And from what I understand of having covered the disease, in many cases, parents have to install locks on the refrigerators to prevent them from getting into them.
As they get older, right. So as infants, they don't want to eat. They then go through a period of very normal appetite and satiety. And then as they get a little bit older in childhood, they begin to develop an excessive interest and awareness of food, and then develop to a point where they just want to eat everything. They don't feel full. And so the parents have to lock the refrigerator, lock the kitchen, install motion activated cameras at their doors and in the kitchen, so that when the child tries to escape from the house to go get food or to, at night to go into the kitchen when the parents are asleep to try to break the locks or to get into food, the cameras will alert them. So it's really like being in prison in your house.
So when did it become evident that this was genetically based?
In the 1970s, it was known that it was genetically based. My mentor here at the University of Florida, Dr. Dan Driscoll in genetics, proved the genetic basis in the early 90s for these other causes. The deletion was known in the 80s, and then in the early 90s, Dr. Driscoll developed a test that proved 100% of Prader-Willi syndrome through different genetic causes for the syndrome.
And when was the first therapy investigated and approved?
So in the mid-90s, growth hormone therapy was investigated for Prader-Willi syndrome. It became FDA approved for treatment of Prader-Willi in 2000 in the U.S. It was slightly before that in Europe and slightly after that in some of the other countries, but it became approved in the late 90s, early 2000s. But growth hormone therapy helps a lot of things in Prader-Willi. It does not help the appetite.
So I would imagine that this is one disease where it must be very hard to be a parent of a child with Prader-Willi because it requires constant vigilance, surveillance 24/7. I'm guessing it must be very hard to go on vacation or go on trips or even go out to a restaurant without constantly watching like a hawk over your child.
Yes. When you asked me earlier how significant was the syndrome, I almost said to you, it's extremely significant if it affects your family, because yes, it is a very, very difficult condition. The divorce rate in this syndrome is extremely high, much higher than the national average. It approaches 90% because it is such a difficult syndrome to manage. It affects and touches literally every aspect of your life as a human being that you can imagine. It's not just appetite. Of course, think about when you're hungry. What does that affect? It affects your behaviors. It affects your mood. It affects your sleep. It affects your education because you can't concentrate as well. And this syndrome does that. And there's, you know, behaviors that occur like compulsive behaviors, self-mutilatory behaviors, you know, all of that ritualistic behaviors, repetitive behaviors, all of that stuff occurs in this syndrome. And through research over the years, we found that a lot of that is indeed, although we didn't realize that it was tied necessarily to the food issues, we've come to find out that it is related to the food issues, because when you can decrease the appetite drive, some of these symptoms do decrease as well.
Yet over the last 20 years, there's been quite a bit of research. So you would say there's a lot more hope today for parents of these children than there was, let's say, in 1980.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Even 5 years ago, you know, I tell parents all the time when I see new babies these days that this is a different syndrome than it was when I started 23 years ago, completely different syndrome, because there is so much more hope.
So you mentioned earlier that Prader-Willi and Angelman's are basically sister diseases. Can you explain why?
So they both affect the same area of chromosome 15. The difference is that Angelman, you're missing that part of mom's chromosome 15. And in Prader-Willi syndrome, you're missing that part of dad's chromosome 15.
So would you talk a bit about the University of Florida and the research you're conducting at your lab?
So, like I said, I've been doing research at the University of Florida for about 23 years. I started with my mentor, Dr. Driscoll, who is a geneticist, and we started looking at the effects of early treatment with growth hormone therapy on a bunch of parameters in individuals with Prader-Willi syndrome. So growth hormone therapy is currently FDA approved only for 2 and up with Prader-Willi syndrome and only with growth failure. However, what we hypothesized back many years ago was that growth hormone therapy early in life might change the natural history of the syndrome. And indeed, now it is standard of care, although not FDA approved, it is standard of care to treat infants at diagnosis with growth hormone therapy. This helps motor development, speech development, all of the developmental delays. It also has been shown to help with cognitive development, which is why we can now say mild to moderate, you know, intellectual disability or learning differences. And so it's really made a profound difference in the trajectory of the syndrome from a natural history perspective. But then since that, I have then been concentrating on the thing that that growth hormone doesn't help, which is the appetite. So, you know, we were thrilled that growth hormone therapy helps so much of the syndrome and helps alter the natural history somewhat, but the appetite is what holds these individuals back.
And how do you control the appetite then, if not through the growth hormone?
So right now it is being a prisoner in their own home. It is locking everything, cameras, you know, it's a horrible situation.
I'm guessing that during the pandemic, it must have been hell for these parents because nobody could go anywhere.
That's correct. It was hell. It was awful. You know, and of course, every person is different. For some individuals with Prader-Willi syndrome, they actually did somewhat better at home because it was such a, you know, a controlled environment, right? Everything was locked. There was absolutely zero access to food. There was eyes on 24/7. For most families, though, it was hell on earth because the kids had no routine. They lost their activities. They lost, you know, that ability to be out, you know, and away from their parents for a while. You know, this, as you mentioned earlier, this is a 24/7 disease. Like, the parents really often don't sleep, you know, because the kids can get up at night and get to food. And so they have to be 100% vigilant 100% of the time. And during COVID, that was extremely difficult and stressful for so many.
And also, it was more difficult to get exercise. So physical activity was reduced.
Absolutely.
How we talk about obesity, how obese? I mean, how severe is this?
You know, it's very variable. It really depends on the family and probably other genetic influences. You know, I mean, just like there are in regular, you know, weight gain, there are other genetic influences that play a role here. In general, I mean, these individuals can become very obese if left to their own devices. Most of the time, the families have things locked and under control. And so the obesity is not nearly as severe as you would tend to imagine with some, you know, with a syndrome where they don't feel full. Because we can now give proactive guidance. Kids are now diagnosed in infancy. The average age of diagnosis is 1.2 months of age. And so we can now give proactive guidance to the families to say, okay, lock up your garbage cans, lock your cabinets, keep your child away from, you know, whatever. Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it's hard, but we, you know, don't put a refrigerator in your house that somebody can have access to.
There's no way to screen infants, newborn screening for this, correct?
Not yet.
Just as an aside, we did discuss this briefly. What's likely on the horizon for gene therapy, since in other diseases we have seen breakthroughs such as spinal muscular atrophy and now most recently Duchenne muscular dystrophy? Is there any chance that a gene therapy could work for Prader-Willi?
Of course, there's always a chance that it could work, and research is currently being done on that. The problem is that this syndrome affects 10 genes on chromosome 15. And that makes it more difficult to be amenable to gene therapy because there are so many genes involved. And even though this disease has been described for a very, very long time and really has been known as a genetic disease since the 1970s, the function of each of those genes is still not completely known. And so that also makes it extremely difficult to be amenable to gene therapy. I think it will happen. I just think that it's a little bit more difficult than something where there's a single gene mutation like in SMA.
So what specific therapies can we look forward to in the next couple of years?
So there is a drug called DCCR, or diazoxide choline extended release, made by a company called Soleno. And we've done phase 3 clinical trials on it. Unfortunately, those trials were conducted somewhat during COVID. And so it messed up the results, unfortunately, to the point where the primary outcome measure, which was a thing called the hyperphagia questionnaire, did not come out to be statistically significant. Again, as you mentioned, because of COVID, because things were all messed up for everybody. But it was remarkable. I've done this for 23 years. I can honestly say that the coolest thing in my career is that I've seen two drugs that have altered the natural history of a syndrome. And I don't know how many people can say that in their career, but it's really a very exciting thing for me. Growth hormone altered the natural history, and this drug alters the natural history. So the drug works in two ways. It works both in the brain and in the periphery.
What is the name of the drug slowly?
DCCR, or diazoxide choline continuous release.
And who makes it?
Soleno Therapeutics.
And so what's, this is currently in a phase 3?
So the phase 3 trial has been completed because it failed to meet the primary outcome measure, unfortunately, due to COVID, although the secondary outcome measures were positive, statistically positive. The FDA has asked, and the EMA has asked the company to do another trial. Unfortunately, this is a rare disease with a limited population. So what they were able to do was to conduct a randomized withdrawal trial of the people that were on the drug. So after 4 years of being on this medication, half of the individuals were randomly then assigned to be on placebo for 4 months, and half were able to stay on the medication. And those results will be upcoming probably September 2023. So we don't know the results of the trial yet. It's not finished. But during that long-term open label extension of the medication after the clinical trial was completed, it completely changed the natural history of the disease for these families. It not only decreased hyperphagia, it decreased the food stealing episodes. People were able to unlock. They were able to turn their cameras off. The kids now can go to parties. They can go to events. They can, you know, they're normal kids. They can go to school dances without parent supervision, you know, just with their friends. They can have sleepovers. It really allowed them to be typical kids. They were able to, you know, attend sports events outside their school and travel on a bus and stay in a hotel with their peers, and which was never going to happen before with this syndrome.
That's wonderful. We're just about out of time. I wish you continued success in your research. We appreciate very much that you've spoken with us today. Thank you. This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.